The Synthesis of Yoga, Sri Aurobindo. Continuing with Part 1, The Yoga of Divine Works. Now, Chapter 8, The Supreme Will, page 208. In the light of this progressive manifestation of the Spirit, first apparently bound in the ignorance, then free in the power and wisdom of the Infinite, we can better understand the great and crowning injunction of the Gita to the Karma Yogin, abandoning all dharmas, all principles and laws and rules of conduct, take refuge in me alone. All standards and rules are temporary constructions founded upon the needs of the ego in its transition from matter to spirit. These makeshifts have a relative imperativeness so long as we rest satisfied in the stages of transition, content with the physical and vital life, attached to the mental movement, or even fixed in the ranges of the mental plane that are touched by the spiritual lusters. But beyond is the unwalled wideness of a supramental infinite consciousness, and there all temporary structures cease. It is not possible to enter utterly into the spiritual truth of the eternal and infinite if we have not the faith and courage to trust ourselves into the hands of the Lord of all things and the friend of all creatures, and leave utterly behind us our mental limits and measures. At one moment, we must plunge without hesitation, reserve, fear, or scruple into the ocean of the free, the infinite, the absolute. After the law, liberty. After the personal, after the general, after the universal standards, there is something greater, the impersonal plasticity, the divine freedom, the transcendent force, and the supernal impulse. After the straight path of the ascent, the wide plateaus on the summit. There are three stages of the ascent. At the bottom, the bodily life, enslaved to the pressure of necessity and desire. In the middle, the mental, higher emotional and psychic rule that feels after greater interests, aspirations, experiences. At the summits, first a deeper psychic and spiritual state, and then a supramental eternal consciousness in which all our aspirations and seekings discover their own intimate significance. In the bodily life, first desire and need, and then the practical good of the individual and the society are the governing consideration, the dominant force. In the mental life, ideas and ideals rule, ideas that are half-lights wearing the garb of truth, ideals formed by the mind as a result of a growing but still imperfect intuition and experience. Whenever the mental life prevails and the bodily diminishes its brute insistence, man, the mental being, feels pushed by the urge of mental nature to mold in the sense of the idea or the ideal the life of the individual. And in the end, even the vaguer, more complex life of the society is forced to undergo this subtle process. In the spiritual life, or when a higher power than mind has manifested and taken possession of the nature, these limited motive forces recede, dwindle, tend to disappear. The spiritual or supramental self, the divine being, the supreme and immanent reality, must be alone the Lord within us and shape freely our final development according to the highest, widest, most integral expression possible of the law of our nature. In the end, that nature acts in the perfect truth and its spontaneous freedom, for it obeys only the luminous power of the eternal. The individual has nothing further to gain, no desire to fulfill. He has become a portion of the impersonality or the universal personality of the eternal. No other object than the manifestation and play of the divine spirit in life and the maintenance and conduct of the world in its march towards the divine goal can move him to action. Mental ideas, opinions, constructions are his no more, for his mind has fallen into silence. It is only a channel for the light and truth of the divine knowledge. Ideals are too narrow for the vastness of his spirit. It is the ocean of the infinite that flows through him and moves him forever. Whoever sincerely enters the path of works must leave behind him the stage in which need and desire are the first law of our acts. For whatever desires still trouble his being, he must, if he accepts the high aim of yoga, put them away from him into the hands of the Lord within us. The Supreme Power will deal with them for the good of the sadhaka and for the good of all. In effect, we find that once this surrender is done, always provided the rejection is sincere, egoistic indulgence of desire may for some time recur under the continued impulse of past nature, but only in order to exhaust its acquired momentum and to teach the embodied being in his most unteachable part, his nervous, vital, emotional nature, by the reactions of desire, by its grief and unrest, bitterly contrasted with calm periods of the higher peace or marvelous movements of divine Ananda, that egoistic desire is not a law for the soul that seeks liberation or aspires to its own original God nature. Afterwards, the element of desire in those impulsions will be thrown away or persistently eliminated by a constant denying and transforming pressure. Only the pure force of action in them, pravritti, justified by an equal delight in all work and result that is inspired or imposed from above, will be preserved in the happy harmony of a final perfection. To act, to enjoy, is the normal law and right of the nervous being, but to choose by personal desire its action and enjoyment is only its ignorant will, not its right. Alone, the supreme and universal will must choose. Action must change into a dynamic movement of that will. Enjoyment must be replaced by the play of a pure spiritual ananda. All personal will is either a temporary delegation from on high or a usurpation by the ignorant asura. The social law, that second term of our progress, is a means to which the ego is subjected in order that it may learn discipline by subordination to a wider collective ego. This law may be quite empty of any moral content and may express only the needs or the practical good of the society as each society conceives it. Or it may express those needs and that good, but modified and colored and supplemented by a higher moral or ideal law. It is binding on the developing, but not yet perfectly developed individual in the shape of social duty, family obligation, communal or national demand, so long as it is not in conflict with his growing sense of the higher right. But the sadhaka of the Karma Yoga will abandon this also to the Lord of Works. After he has made this surrender, his social impulses and judgments will, like his desires, only be used for their exhaustion or, it may be, so far as they are still necessary for a time, to enable him to identify his lower mental nature with mankind in general or with any grouping of mankind in its works and hopes and aspirations. But after that brief time is over, they will be withdrawn, and a divine government will alone abide. He will be identified with the divine and with others only through the divine consciousness and not through the mental nature. For even after he is free, the sadhaka will be in the world, and to be in the world is to remain in works. But to remain in works without desire is to act for the good of the world in general, or for the kind, or the race, or for some new creation to be evolved on the earth, or some work imposed by the divine will within him. And this must be done either in the framework provided by the environment or the grouping in which he is born or placed, or else in one which is chosen and created for him by a divine direction. Therefore, in our perfection, there must be nothing left in the mental being which conflicts with or prevents our sympathy and free self-identification with the kind, the group, or whatever collective expression of the divine he is meant to lead, help, or serve. But in the end, it must become a free self-identification through identity with the divine, and not a mental bond or moral tie of union or a vital association dominated by any kind of personal, social, national, communal, or creedal egoism. If any social law is obeyed, it will not be from physical necessity or from the sense of personal or general interest or for expediency or because of the pressure of the environment or from any sense of duty, but solely for the sake of the Lord of Works and because it is felt or known to be the divine will that the social law or rule or relation, as it stands, can still be kept as a figure of the inner life, and the minds of men must not be disturbed by its infringement. If, on the other hand, the social law, rule, or relation is disregarded, that too will not be for the indulgence of desire, personal will, or personal opinion, but because a greater rule is felt that expresses the law of the Spirit, or because it is known that there must be in the march of the divine all will a movement towards the changing, exceeding, or abolition of existing laws and forms for the sake of a freer, larger life necessary to the world's progress. There is still left the moral law or the ideal, and these, even to many who think themselves free, appear forever sacred and intangible. But the sadhaka, his gaze turned always to the heights, will abandon them to him whom all ideals seek imperfectly and fragmentarily to express. All moral qualities are only a poor and rigid travesty of his spontaneous and illimitable perfection. The bondage to sin and evil passes away with the passing of nervous desire, for it belongs to the quality of vital passion, impulsion, or drive of propensity in us, rajoguna, and is extinguished with the transformation of that mode of nature. But neither must the aspirant remain subject to the gilded or golden chain of a conventional or a habitual or a mentally ordered or even a high or clear sattvic virtue. That will be replaced by something profounder and more essential than the minor, inadequate thing that men call virtue. The original sense of the word was manhood, and this is a much larger and deeper thing than the moral mind and its structure. The culmination of karma yoga is a yet higher and deeper state that may perhaps be called soulhood. For the soul is greater than the man. A free soulhood, spontaneously welling out in works of a supreme truth and love, will replace human virtue. But this supreme truth cannot be forced to inhabit the petty edifices of the practical reason, or even confined in the more dignified constructions of the larger ideative reason that imposes its representations as if they were pure truth on the limited human intelligence. This supreme love will not necessarily be consistent. Much less will it be synonymous with the partial and feeble, ignorant, and emotion-ridden movements of human attraction, sympathy, and pity. The petty law cannot bind the vaster movement. The mind's partial attainment cannot dictate its terms to the soul's supreme fulfillment. At first, the higher love and truth will fulfill its movement in the sadhaka according to the essential law or way of his own nature. For that is the special aspect of the divine nature, the particular power of the supreme shakti, out of which his soul has emerged into the play, not limited indeed by the forms of this law or way, for the soul is infinite. But still, its stuff of nature bears that stamp, evolves fluently along those lines or turns around the spiral curves of that dominating influence. He will manifest the divine truth movement according to the temperament of the sage or the lion king fighter or the lover and enjoyer or the worker and servant or in any combination of essential attributes, gunas, that may constitute the form given to his being by its own inner urge. It is this self-nature playing freely in his acts which men will see in him, and not a conduct cut, chalked out, artificially regulated by any lesser rule or by any law from outside. But there is a yet higher attainment. There is an infinity, anantya, in which even this last limitation is exceeded. Because the nature is utterly fulfilled and its boundaries vanish. There the soul lives without any boundaries, for it uses all forms and molds according to the divine will in it. But it is not restrained, it is not tied down, it is not imprisoned in any power or form that it uses. This is the summit of the path of works, and this the utter liberty of the soul in its actions. In reality, it has there no actions, for all its activities are a rhythm of the supreme and sovereignly proceed from that alone, like a spontaneous music out of the infinite. Stopping mid-page 213.